United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Beverly Martin, and I'm here with Judge Kevin Newsom and Judge Keith Watkins. And we are sorry we can't be together in person, but we're actually kind of getting used to doing it this way. I hope it works well for you all today. Judge Newsom and I are delighted to have with us this week Judge Watkins. He's been so inundated as a district judge for so long. We hadn't seen much of him as a visiting judge, but it's been a real pleasure to have you here with us this week, Judge Watkins.
Thank you.
We've got three cases today. I have asked Ms. Tisa to give you 2 minutes notice before the end of your argument and to tell you when your time has expired. Sometimes there's a little delay. She says it a couple of times just to be sure that everybody's on the same sheet. With that, the other thing is, I guess we promised counsel 2 minutes of uninterrupted argument the first time you speak. So with that, we'll get underway with the first case, the United States versus David Schwarz.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sonia O'Donnell, represent appellant David Schwarz. Your Honors, my client, David Schwarz, is serving a life term for two counts of a life term because it was 40 years and he's 60-some years old, for two counts of bank fraud, two wires totaling less than $300,000, which the government said were cash advances, closing advances, and with the corresponding false statements, which are the loan documents, resulted in acquittal. So there is no material misrepresentation. And for conspiracy to commit bank fraud, where Schwarz was not involved in the loan application process, the loans were done by different departments in a different city and were under the co-conspirator, supposed co-conspirator, Clark, who was tried in a separate case and was acquitted, actually, of the conspiracy but convicted of the bank fraud, which is one of the issues in this case where the government used against my client. Numerous errors in the trial, each one alone is reversible, but certainly cumulatively they are reversible. Using a conviction of a co-conspirator, Clark, for the substantive conviction of bank fraud as substantive evidence of guilt against my client under Eason, that is, and it was almost the exact colloquy, is reversible. Denial of the continuance in this case is reversible. I think the facts show that the attorney needed the time, and the prejudice is clear on with the documents that the that Mr. Schwarz has sent to the court. Limiting the theory of the defense, this is not Powell. That was error. Refusal to give the reliance of counsel instruction is clear error, especially if the court sees that there is a document, again, that counsel did not have but was from Greenberg-Torek that showed the advice of counsel, and the improper use, incredible amount of 404B evidence, the use of an IRS witness that was said to be a fact witness, but instead ended up giving opinion after opinion, sometimes about things she knew nothing about. Appellant did not receive a fair trial. It was not just trial by ambush, but a trial where he had to defend against four or five different charges which were not charged and didn't appear in the indictment, where numerous motions of limine limited his defense. He was unable to defend because he didn't have documents that he should have had because his lawyer did not get sufficient time to prepare.
Ms. O'Donnell, this is Judge Newsom. I think you've probably in your introduction rattled off about eight different errors, but you're not going to have time to cover all of those today. So what horses do you want to ride today?
Well, Your Honor, I wanted to discuss, first of all, the sufficiency because I wanted the court to see that, you know, and that's the first one I want to discuss. I think it is very clear in our brief that there was a use, and it's almost exactly the use of the conviction against Schwartz. It was almost the exact colloquy as in Eason. There was no invited error. I think we show that and we show why. I think with regard to the continuance, the court may have some questions.
Hold on one sec. Let's take one at a time. So you want to talk about the introduction of the co-defendant's conviction. Before we go to the continuance, let's just pause on that and Eason. I mean, it can't possibly be the law, right, that your guy can get on the stand and say, in effect, well, no one's ever been able to prove that my co-defendant did anything wrong, and, you know, invite the jury to conclude that the co-defendant walked and that the government's just hamstrung to sit there and bite its tongue. That can't possibly be the law, can it?
Your Honor, that's not what happened, and those are not the facts of this case. The facts of this case are that all he said was there's been all this litigation, and he never said anything about Clark's case. He said litigation because the government had tried four different cases, the SEC case, the civil case, all these cases that the jury knew about. He didn't say the criminal case or Clark's criminal case. He said litigation. And his attorney said that to the court. His attorney explained. He said litigation. Instead, the court allowed the government to use the conviction.
Let me ask you a question. Let's just deal with the exact quote, and you can tell me if I've got it wrong. But so Schwartz said on the stand, on recross, he says that Clark, quote, is supposed to be presumed innocent, close quote, and so far nobody's been able to show anything that is an impropriety. Is that right? Do I have the quote right?
Well, but that's not the quote that led to the this question. What happened is the question, I believe, is from his attorney. Now, the only other possible impropriety is the cash to close coming from somebody else other than the buyer, correct? And then he says, that's the theory of the prosecution. I hear that. I know that's not the first time I've heard that theory. That's been in all these lawsuits, and so far nobody's been able to show anything then that is an impropriety.
What does it mean when he says Clark is presumed innocent?
Your Honor, I think he was musing about Clark, and I think they had just the government asked a lot of questions about, well, you know, Clark did this and Clark did that, and I guess he was just saying, well, I mean, he's presumed innocent, but the question that led to this, to the use of the conviction against him is what I just read the court, because although the government didn't object, they then, you know, waited until that and said, well, you know, he was saying that this was, you know, a theory in the lawsuits, and, you know, his attorney said, this is, you know, lawsuits is not the criminal conviction. I mean, this is an egregious error. And I mean, the use, you know, the use of a criminal conviction of a co-defendant to infer that this defendant is guilty, and then he did it again in closing argument, is itself reversible error. But when put together with all the other errors in this case, including the, you know, the fact that there were a lot of documents that we have found and sent to the court that a continuance would have allowed this counsel to search in this unsearchable drive. And all the errors together definitely require reversal. But even if there's some doubt in the court's mind about whether this is itself alone reversible, which there shouldn't be, because I just read exactly how the colloquy went. And by the way, the government didn't say anything then. They just sandbagged him later. Okay, so he couldn't fix it. He couldn't nothing. I mean, and then they used that conviction against him. And, Your Honor, there are a number of errors, and I know our briefs are very clear on what the errors are, but I you know, on the sufficiency of the evidence, there are only two remaining substantive counts that are specifically tied to the false statements in the indictment and were tied at trial. And the false statements well, there's no evidence that there was any, you know, material misrepresentation. As a matter of fact, the false statements have been...
Counsel, 2 minutes. 2 minutes.
The false statements, there were acquittals on the false statements, and there is no evidence that Mr. Schwartz joined a conspiracy to commit bank fraud. He was not involved in the loans. He was not, didn't know anything about the loans. There was, and there was no evidence that he knew anything about the loans. And the two people who testified that they wrote somebody's name in on the loan applications for Clark's relatives said that they didn't tell anything to Schwartz about anything on the loan applications or their signatures. There's nothing wrong with the leaseback. There's a document. You know, they acted as if this is some nefarious conspiracy, some Ponzi scheme. It wasn't. They were legitimate apartments that were bought in a time when, you know, when later on there was a crash, which he was not allowed to tell the jury. This is not a Powell situation. This is a situation where they put in a bunch of, a number of people who said they bought apartments and lost money. Well, a lot of people lost money at this time because there was a crash. He was not allowed to say that. He was not saying that the banks should have looked into it or done better appraisal like in Powell. He was just, he wanted his defense, which is, I did not cause these people to lose their apartments. And the leaseback, there's a 20-page opinion from Greenberg Traurig, a very reputable firm, that says that the leaseback should be done later, because otherwise they're securities. And because of that, that's how they were done, and that's why they weren't on the loan documents, which he didn't see anyway. Now, the fact that that Clark and Coleman were acquitted of the conspiracy is not important.
Sorry.
For this, I know that it doesn't bind the court. However, it does show, and you, the court can just look at, there's no evidence of a conspiracy here, and I don't know who the conspirator, what conspirator, who did he conspire with? He wasn't even in the same department. He didn't know anything about the loans. There was no conspiracy to commit bank fraud. Thank you, Your Honor. I think my time may be over.
Okay.
It's difficult to, because I don't have the...
Yes, your time is up.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Sonia Ralston for the United States. Clark and Schwartz agreed to work together with the help of others to defraud banks and investors out of hundreds of millions of dollars. K-Clubs was a fraud from the start when Clark and Schwartz arranged for the first seven condo sales through straw purchasers. These so-called sales were frauds because the paperwork indicated they were arm's-length transactions involving real buyers, when in fact the buyer and seller were the same entity. The fraud allowed K-Clubs both to get cash from a purchase money mortgage without an actual purchase and to set artificially high prices for the sales that were then used to buoy appraisals for all subsequent sales. Thus, in both the initial and subsequent sales, K-Clubs induced banks to make loans they would not have made had they known the truth. In the fall of 2006, K-Clubs suffered a cash crunch, and Clark and Schwartz again arranged a trio of nominee sales wherein K-Clubs purported to sell units to third parties but really sold to itself, essentially using federally insured banks as their own personal piggy banks, in part to repay other debts, defrauding Peter to repay Paul. And the evidence proved that throughout the scheme, Schwartz knew the nominee sales were fake. He charged Clark's ownership account for the down payments and mortgages, showing he knew Clark was the real owner of those units. He wired the cash to close from K-Club's account directly to the title companies. He saw the HUD ones memorializing a sale to a non-existent buyer. When their Ponzi scheme fell to earth, the defendants continued to lie about what happened and cover up the fraud to their investors, the SEC, the IRS, and the jury here. The jury nonetheless convicted Schwartz of bank fraud, conspiracy, and tax obstruction. Other than the tax obstruction conviction, the trial was fair, the convictions are just, and the sentence is appropriate. The continuance their argument about the continuance fails to account for facts this court has held relevant, including the years Schwartz spent litigating the same issues on the same discovery against the SEC, the fact that the government handed him its case on a silver platter months before trial, and his availability to assist counsel throughout the process. He has also never pointed to a single piece of evidence that would have led to his acquittal. In sum, the district court did not abuse its discretion. I'd like to start quickly on the issue about the Clark's conviction. As Judge Newsom pointed out, I think if you read the record, it speaks for itself. The district court didn't abuse its discretion. It offered the defendant redirect if there was anything that needed to be cleared up. This is at docket 217 at page 73. What happened in closing, please read the transcript. The defendant's brief misrepresents what happened. There's a paragraph break before he continues on to talking about, you know, there was obviously fraud here. That's at 217, page 158. It's on plain error review for the closing argument issue. And this is not Eason. This is pure impeachment. The government asked for and the court gave a limiting instruction to that effect. And the closing argument is clearly an aside. He says, by the way, to introduce this one sentence, it's not relied on. It's not substantive evidence. It was just impeachment. And that is
acceptable. So let me ask you, this is Judge Newsom. Let me ask you a follow-up question. Although Ms. O'Donnell didn't cite this portion of Eason, there's a passage in Eason that says, it is clear that a conviction other than that of the witness himself is not admissible on the issue of the witness's credibility. What does that mean?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think that that's dicta that's, you know, not necessary to the holding there. And I think, as you pointed out in your questions before, that simply can't be the law. You know, it can't be the fact that the defendant or any witness is able to get on the stand and lie through his teeth about something, and the other party, the government, is hamstrung from doing anything about it. If you lie, you lie, and lies are relevant to the witness's credibility. I mean, it's different, right? It's only for impeachment, right? If the person isn't testifying, then it's not relevant. And, you know, we're not impeaching by the fact of the conviction. It's not – so maybe what Eason means is you can't say – introduce somebody's conviction in like a 608, 609 situation as the fact of the conviction is itself impeachment of the witness. Although, again, the rules of evidence indicate that if you're impeaching the declarant of a hearsay statement, that's admissible. But in the sense of you're straight up impeaching the witness because they lied about the existence of the conviction, I don't think that's what the statement in Eason could be possibly be covering.
Do you think, is there some difference in your mind, I've been sort of struggling with this, is there some difference in your mind between impeaching a witness's credibility or a comment like this opening the door generally to sort of just rebutting the statement, setting the record straight, setting a misrepresentation straight and impeaching a witness's credibility? Might it be that Eason only runs to the latter and not to the former?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, again, in the district court's discretion about, you know, weighing the costs and benefits, but seeing how directly impeaching the question is going to be, which goes to, you know, exactly what was said that needs to be impeached. And if you just nudge the door open a little bit, that's different than swinging it wide open and walking straight through. I think the district court here, you know, heard the argument about this is referring to civil lawsuits. The court didn't agree with that. It said this is a fair question, and that's within the district court's discretion. I don't think there's anything here that shows a wild abuse of discretion. I'd like to comment briefly on the issue of precluding the defense about the market crash. You know, this was technically precluded as a defense because it's not relevant, which is the right ruling, but a lot of this evidence came in anyway, and you'll see those citations in our brief.
On that issue, this is Beverly Martin. You know, I'm sure you've read United States versus Stein, where this court vacated, you know, a finding of loss because the district court didn't allow the defendant to argue about the loss from the stock market decline of 2008. I mean, doesn't that mean, I mean, doesn't that apply here? I mean, why doesn't it?
Two responses, Your Honor. I think to the extent that the amount of loss is at issue, that might be different when you're talking about sentencing versus, you know, at trial where the amount of loss is not an element of these crimes. And the second would be that to the extent it's saying that market forces, like market declines, are not foreseeable, I think the Supreme Court's decision in Robers, if not abrogates, substantially undercuts that idea. You know, that decision postdates Stein, I think. And there the court held that the defendant is on the hook for restitution in that case, but subtracted the collateral at the post-crash price, not at the, the moment the bank took possession of the collateral price. And so holding the defendant liable for the effect of the crash because the crash is foreseeable. And I think that, market downturns are always foreseeable, especially when talking about real estate. So even in the sentencing context, I think foreseeability is the touchstone, and you would be talking about what's foreseeable. But here, a lot of this evidence...
Can I follow up on that? I'm sorry. Can I follow up on that? So as I understand it, because of the Supreme Court ruling about the tax obstruction counts, we need to vacate those and remand for resentencing. Should we direct the district court to consider Mr. Schwartz's argument about how the stock market decline affected the loss amount at sentencing?
I don't think so for a couple of reasons. The resentencing required by vacating count 8 is essentially a clerical resentencing. It's just vacating one of the $100 assessments and then the sentence on that count, which was concurrent to the others. The loss calculation at sentencing, based on the way the guidelines come out, it's six levels over the top of the guidelines. So you could reduce that loss calculation by six levels and have zero effect on the guidelines, which means that if there was at least $9.5 million of foreseeable loss, the guidelines range is the same. So to get to $9.5 million, you don't have to go very far. Even absent the market crash, there's $9.5 million of loss. The defendant, the conspirator's gain is $67 million. Even if you don't want to use loss, if you just want to use gain as the alternative, and the guidelines say you should use whichever is higher, so that would be a floor, and that's $67 million, which would be a plus 24 instead of a plus 26. But again, that makes no difference in the ultimate calculation of the guidelines because the total offense level was 49. So I don't think, which is a long way of saying that it's harmless. Sorry, I was long-winded about that, but it's...
No,
it's,
I think that was a good answer. Thank you.
And I'd like to point out one more thing about this kind of market-did-it issue, which is that the things fell apart in 2006 and early 2007, which is before the market crashed, and that was brought up at trial. After the defendant did make this argument, he made it in his own testimony, he made it in closing, so I don't think he was really that hamstrung from presenting that. I want to touch briefly on the continuance issue. The defendant bears a really high burden to show the denial of continuance is an abuse of discretion, and it requires pointing out specific substantial prejudice, which is that he has to identify the document or documents or evidence, from a witness that would have been introduced at trial that would have led to a different outcome, as this court has said, an acquittal. He's got none of that. The closest counsel comes is this Greenberg-Torig memo, which is Exhibit 6 in their supplemental appendix. And this is a memo talking about how to structure the leaseback program so that the sales don't become securities. It's about securities law. Now, if the charge here were securities fraud, I could see how maybe that would be relevant, but that wasn't the charge. And that's the difference, if you go back and parse these indictments, between the first indictment that was brought against Clark, where he got a hung jury. That involves this type of investor securities fraud. And the second one, where he's convicted of the bank fraud, which is the same charge against Schwartz here, the bank fraud. So the securities advice that they get from Greenberg-Torig has nothing to do with the bank fraud. Greenberg-Torig, nor Callahan, nor Phoenix, nor Melanson, nobody ever told them it's okay to fill out loan applications where you say you're selling it to someone and that person is not actually buying the property. Nobody ever told them that. And he doesn't testify to any of that. There's nothing in the record supporting an advice of counsel defense, which is a very fact-specific defense.
This is Judge Watkins. Let me ask a follow-up on something you said before because our time's running out. You said that the defense was not hamstrung by these failure to grant continuances. How long had Mr. Duffy been involved in this case when he filed the omnibus motion in limine on mid-November or maybe late November? How long had he been on the Clark and Schwartz conspiracy?
So Mr. Smith, the trial attorney, was appointed on October 31st.
I'm not asking about Mr. Smith. I'm asking about Mr. Duffy.
Oh, Mr. Duffy, the prosecutor, for several years.
4 years, it appears to me. At that time, then Mr. Smith had been on the case for 3 weeks. He had to respond and did respond on December the 6th. And in his response, he made the first, maybe the second or third of many, many indications throughout the entire record that he has not had time to look at these documents, 3 terabytes of documents, 40 boxes of banking records, 4 boxes of Clark trial transcripts, 1,000 pages of Clark's testimony, 866,000 pages just of emails alone. How could he not be hamstrung by not being given more than basically 90 days, 92 days, unless you give him Christmas and New Year's, to get ready for this case?
So I think two minutes,
counsel.
Thank you, Ms. Tisa. The first is that you're looking at the standard, which is that he needs to show if he had had more time, he would have been acquitted, and he hasn't done that. But the second, more substantive answer is that Schwartz was available to help. All of this discovery came from him. It's his emails, his bank records. He knows exactly what happened, and he had been litigating these issues, the same issues essentially, against the SEC for quite some time. So if there was there, if there was some smoking gun that proved his innocence, he knew what it was. He could have shown
counsel. This is not about what Schwartz knew. This is what about Sky Smith knew. And before November the 30th, Sky Smith, for all the record shows, never heard of these guys or of a $750 million scheme, or of the 150 associated companies, the 157 associated bank accounts. How can one solo practitioner who did ask for continuances repeatedly, including right before trial the second time, and he asked for extra help with lawyers. The government had five lawyers with Clark and 4 lawyers and 4 years with Schwartz. And Clark had 2 years, basically, to 20 months to prepare for his first trial, 24 months to prepare for his second trial. Schwartz had 120 days from which to subtract basically 3 weeks of trial and then preparation. So isn't it plain without, isn't the prejudice plain?
Your Honor, I push back on the idea that Schwartz's availability and his knowledge is irrelevant. This court held in Edouard that is relevant, the defendant's role in shortening the time, his availability to help. So I think that is relevant. And the second is that the district court didn't abuse its discretion. The district court had all of this information in front of it and was available, had seen all of this. And I think the district court was in the position to know what was necessary or not. And I don't think the government had 5 lawyers. As I read the record, there's only 2, and Mr. Hayes doesn't enter his appearance until the end of January. And I see that my time has expired. We ask you to review what's cited in our brief. Thank you.
Your Honor, Sonia O'Donnell. I'd like to address first the facts of the continuance. There were a number of continuances requested by the solo practitioner who also had a trial in between these, close to 4 months that he had to prepare, and he clearly set out the reasons why he needed the continuance. The court has the drive. I've just now tried to get into the drive while I was preparing, and I had to have help to get into the drive. It is an enormous drive. You cannot find anything. This index that they say is an index is not an index. It is not searchable. The 800 and some thousand emails are not searchable, and the evidence is undisputed in the record. Schwartz testified that when he left all the documents. And there are, we just pulled 23 documents. We don't know how many more there are. But this document of Greenberg-Turek is not just a document about the leasebacks. The government used the leasebacks as if it was some fraudulent scheme that wasn't told to the bank, and it wasn't. They were done after the closings because the lawyers told them to do it after the closing. Also in those documents, there are financial statements. Schwartz testified that the related transactions, there is nothing illegal about them, were put into the financial statements. There's two financial statements for both related transactions, for, you know, both years, for the 2004 and the 2006, and that's documents 12 and 13. The counsel did not have that document because he didn't know, he couldn't search it. There's also a document that shows that one of the bank employees was fixing the loans and altering them, and he pled guilty. Schwartz didn't know anything about that. There's a list of all the numerous, you know, the 23 documents, and there may be others, and the reason we sent this list and the reason we pulled them is so the court could see that not only was it obviously just from the time period and the amount of evidence in this case not enough time for counsel to prepare, but that there's actual prejudice for the court to see that this was an unfair trial. He could not defend because his counsel didn't know. He also asked for help to have another counsel appointed. I mean, and the judge denied that. So I think the continuance, there is definitely a reversible error. I think in this case, the record is made that the continuance was merited and that it wasn't granted. I also...
This is Judge Watkins. Let me follow up on that. There is some suggestion by the government that Mr. Schwartz's counsel contributed to some of these delays, and of course the court repeatedly said you've had plenty of time. Did counsel for Schwartz contribute to any of these delays?
I don't know what she meant by counsel for Schwartz contributed to delays. I mean,
well, that's not a clear question. The implication is that somehow counsel for Schwartz is responsible for not being prepared for trial in this period of time. I'll just ask you, what's the evidence of that?
There is no evidence that he did anything but try to prepare, Your Honor. I mean, he was appointed on October 31st, and the trial took place February 21st. There's no evidence that he was not prepared. In fact, he did really well in cross-examination. He prepared as best he could, but he did not have the documents. He did not have enough discovery that was available to him to be able to mount the defense that he needed. It's not because he wasn't that he contributed to it. He did the best he could, but he did tell the court, "I have this drive. I do not have time." And the court should have known that and it's clear that, you know, the government had years to prepare for this case. They tried Clark twice, and they had two lawyers, and they expected defendants, you know, Schwartz's counsel to prepare and to look into this drive, which, as the court can see, had very valuable evidence, which you could not find. He had to make a choice, I'm sure, to either look through and know the case or spend what took us, you know, I would say like a month to with another attorney looking through it to find some of the things that we did. It is an unsearchable drive. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to... And I just wanted to just... I don't know if I still have time. Do I...
Okay. So you're on pretty good.
I can't. I just wanted to say that the related sales, you know, that the government talked about, were reflected in the financial statements. That is one of those documents that were in the drive that defense counsel did not have. And the government keeps talking about the related sales as if there's something wrong with them. They're not, but not only that, but the only thing that Schwartz, the only duty he had was to reflect them in the financial statements. He was not sales. He was not dealing with the banks. He was not doing anything with the loans. He did what he had to do as CFO. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. O'Donnell.
Thank you.